Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Rituparna Padgiri, on New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Today, I'm going to be in conversation with Hugo Cerón Anaya. Hugo Cerón Anaya is an associate professor of sociology at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, USA. Between 2019 and 2021, he was the director of the Latin American and Latino Studies program at this institution. In 2021, he was a research fellow at the Center for Advanced Latin American Studies at the University of Guadalajara in Mexico. Hugo completed his PhD and MA at the University of Essex in Britain and his undergraduate studies at the National University of Mexico. His research interests lie in the studying upfield. His work analyzes how class structures, racialized dynamics, and gender relations influence the organization of the material and symbolic borders of the upper middle and upper classes in Latin America. He is particularly interested in understanding how dynamics of privilege are reproduced via a wide range of ordinary interactions, such as jokes, sayings, and insults. In 2019, he published Privilege at Play, Class, Race, Gender, and Golf in Mexico, Oxford University Press, which won the 2020 Outstanding Book Award offered by the North American Society for the Sociology of Sports. The book will soon be published in Spanish by the Latin American Council of Social Sciences in its open access library. He's currently working on his second book project, analyzing the relationship between hypergentrification, gender dynamics, local understandings of whiteness, religious identity, and private schools in Guadalajara, Mexico, the second largest metropolis in this country. Hugo, I'm glad to have you with us. Welcome to this interview.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to share more about my work.
Right. So I was very fascinated reading your book, A Privilege at Play, Class, Race, Gender, and Golf in Mexico. And I would like to ask you, what was your inspiration behind writing this book?
Well, I recognize that there has been an amazing body of work in not only in this country or the continent. All over the world, we have amazing body of work exploring notions of masculinity, notions of class, notions of health, among many other issues, among the poor. But I felt and I still feel in the present strongly that we have social scientists miss the opportunity to explore those folks at the upper parts of our social hierarchies. We have sort of missed the opportunity to understand the conditions in which power is reproduced. My feeling is that sometimes we end up with analysis of poverty that are self-contained arguments in which we understand poverty as a condition of being poor. And in order to expand the long argument about relational sociology or the dream to expand our discipline in a relational way, I decided to move the focus of my work not to poor folks in Mexico, but rather to invert the argument and look at those at the upper part of the hierarchy. That is sort of the aim behind my project.
Right. So could you also talk a little bit about your field site and how you got access to it?
Right. And this is an amazing question because this is the most difficult part. People working on the studying up field have been saying for a long time, this argument is not new, of course, that comes from the 1940s. Access to some of these spaces is the most difficult element. So to give you a sense, this sport, it's play in private settings in Mexico as it is in most of the world. Actually, outside of Australia, the United States, Britain, and some couple of other nations, in the rest of the world, golf is a sport played in private settings. The average club in private club in Mexico City, the membership fee cost around $35,000 to give a sense of the community. So I learned the fees through chatting with some golfers, but also with some journalists who start telling me the amount of fees, and that gave me a sense of the community. That, in a way, prevented any discussion about money. I didn't want people to misread my intentions, assuming that I was more interested in money issues for some sort of criminal reason. And instead, I was sort of interested in trying to understand how exactly class operates within this highly exclusive setting. Now, in terms of access probably, as I mentioned before, is this really difficult element to gain. In this case, I use part of my position as a researcher, quote unquote, actually, as a graduate student in Britain, and through networks of Latin American, Mexican folks studying in Britain, I start making my first connections with golfers. And from there, I slowly expanded the network. At the end of each interview, I asked someone, would you please put me in contact with other golfers? And not every single participant actually helped me at the end of the interview. Some of them refused to expand the networks. Doing ethnographic research, not only about wealthy people, but in general, doing ethnographic research, I feel that at some point we need to run on a lucky moment. We need to keep doing interviews. We need to keep looking for participants. And at some point, we may reach that lucky moment. And it happened to me at some point in the interviews, an important executive invited me to his office to do the interview. And a couple of minutes or a bit like half an hour before I show up, a big problem erupted in his company. And then he spent the following 2 hours on the phone, chatting with different people, trying to solve the problem. And for those 2 hours and a bit, I was in the waiting room, just reading everything that was like all the magazines. By the way, it was full of golf magazines. So I was reading all golf magazines, just waiting and waiting. And eventually when he finished solving the problem and he asked me to come to his office, he was extremely embarrassed. And he said, "I'm sorry, I'm extremely embarrassed. You have been waiting for more than 2 hours." And at the end of the interview, he asked me again, "I'm sorry, what can I do for you?" And then I asked him, "Would you mind putting me in contact with other golfers?" And actually this person sort of broke a barrier that I was trying to solve for about a month and a half. As an example, I was trying to reach the editor of the most important golf magazine in the country. And every time that I was calling, his secretary never let me speak with him. She was asking, "Please let me know what you want to talk to him about. Give me your contact information," and so on. But I never heard back from him. And then I was calling a week later, expecting him to answer the phone. And then I was going to explain myself. I found the idea of explaining myself to a secretary really difficult. And after the interview with the executive, he told me, "I have a friend who is the editor of a magazine. You may enjoy chatting with him." He picked the phone and put me in contact directly with this person. That to me was the moment in which I broke a barrier, and this person put me in contact with a lot of other golfers. He was actually fundamental in the development of the project. So in terms of someone interested in doing, starting up work, field work, I will suggest it is difficult. It takes a lot of time. Every single interview cost me 2 weeks of emails and phone calls with a secretary coordinator going back and forth before the person agree on, or before the person actually told me a date and a time in which we could meet. And many times interviews were canceled 15 minutes before the agreed meeting. So it requires a lot of work. It requires a lot of patience. But I will suggest you just keep trying, and eventually some doors will open.
Right. I think what you say totally explains the various kinds of experiences a researcher has when they set out to do ethnographic research work. On that very note, let me also ask you my next question, that what are some of the research methods that you have used in this study? If you could elaborate your reasoning behind them as well.
Right. In this case, I was mainly using historical, ethnographic, and interviews methods. I was, on the one hand, I was interested to understand the question of why this sport, and not basketball, or not baseball, or not cricket, not any other sport. Why this sport, at a global scale, is so deeply connected, identified, associated with wealthy people. So in order to answer that question, I sort of dive into the history of the sport to try to understand what happened, what is that thing that makes this sport so important at a global scale. So there's historical material in the book explaining the history of the sport from its Scottish origins up to its expansion in Latin America and the present, its global expansion. And probably cities like Dubai is a wonderful example to see the continuation of the long trajectory between wealth and this specific sport. In terms of the other methods, doing interviews and ethnographic work require a lot of preparation, a lot of work. I tried to do a lot of research in relationship to the person that I was going to interview, in relationship to the sites that I was eventually invited. Some people started inviting me to the clubs. And through them, I started making other connections. I tried to do a lot of research in terms of the history of the club, so then I can ask people about the dynamics, trajectory, long history of some of these clubs. And in terms of the interviews, I was also trying to prepare, on the one hand, some set questions that I was asking every single participant. But on the other, I was trying also to tailor-made some questions in relationship to the specific people. I should say that also as part of this studying up field, being prepared as a researcher means or is really important, but at the same time, we should be very aware that the normal relationship of power that we establish with workers, with marginalized communities, with racial others within national boundaries, communities, etc., is commonly inverted when we are dealing with wealthy people. I recall reading a wonderful study about someone interviewing important politicians and how this researcher learned that she was commonly seated against a wall. And then she started noticing the pattern. And then she later on learned that clocks were commonly hung on that wall. So these important politicians were constantly sitting here against the clock. And then the politicians were all the time in charge of time. And then they decided when to start and when to finish. These type of dynamics are also present in my case. I recall probably the most important example. I was chasing an important executive in a global corporation. I knew that he was attending a tournament, and I gained access to that tournament. And then I approached him at the beginning, and he said, "Oh, yeah, of course, we can chat." Of course, after the end of the tournament. So I stayed there for about 5 hours waiting for him. At the end, I approached him and he said, "Oh, of course, yeah, we can sit in the bar." We sat and the interview lasted no more than 2 minutes. In less than 2 minutes, he found my questions and all the work I put into preparing the interview on interesting or on amusing, or he found me like he didn't have time. And then he said, "Sorry, I need to chat with someone else." And then he moved to the following table and start chatting very vividly, joking with some of the folks who have participated in the tournament. So with that, I'm saying that some of the methods that we have learned as sociologists, sometimes we need to do some, we need to twist them. We need to be ready to prepare to engage in different methodology to reach these folks. And also in the discussion of methods, currently I'm still in the studying up field, but in the case of my new project, I'm starting playing around with social media. We have this phenomenon in which people are broadcasting all their lives on social media. So I think that social media still have an untapped potentiality to offer us a lot of research, or a lot of evidence about the life of the wealthy and the way in which class, gender, and racialized elements are constantly portrayed in consumption among wealthy people, the type of brands, the type of things they engage with. So for this project, I will start exploring TikTok and Twitter as ways to gather more information about these wealthy communities that now I'm working on.
Very interesting. You know, Hugo, in your book, you write that your initial interest in economic elites, privilege, and class inequalities led you to this research on golf. I wanted to ask, how do you think is golf connected to capitalism and imperialism, and how it becomes a site to understand the intricacies between class and race and gender?
Thank you for the question. That's an amazing question. Let me share that in the literature on sociology of sports, more so globally. It is usually argued that cricket is a sport of empire. And the argument goes that cricket, it was sort of so deeply connected with the British Empire that whenever Britain developed colonial relationships, cricket was at the center in the Caribbean, in India, in South Africa, etc. I will argue that when we expand our notion of empire, not only to capture the British Empire, we should think of golf as that sport of empire. Let me elaborate on my argument. Yes, of course, cricket expanded its borders alongside the empire, and we can almost map historically the expansion of cricket clubs alongside new colonies being incorporated into the British Empire. But so was the case of golf. When we look at the case of golf, golf also followed empire. The first club founded outside of Scotland or England was Ireland. And then Ireland, we have all the new colonies and the creation of some golf clubs. But then we have the collapse of the empire, and then we have the role of the United States expanding this sport. The first, you can think of Afghanistan, the first golf club founded there by the U.S. Army. But you can think of Central America, the first golf course in Central America, Panama, founded by the U.S. Army. So we have the role of the U.S. Army expanding this sport. But then we have since the 60s the process in which it is not the U.S. Army only. But we have, of course, we have the case of Japan expanding golf, particularly at the other side of the world from the United States. But apart from Japan, what we have since the late 70s and 80s are global financial corporations pretty much fueling the new development of courses, tournaments all around the world. And I mentioned before Dubai, and Dubai is a perfect example to look at the way in which the sport is deeply connected to empire, notions of empire. And you can easily look for pictures of Dubai in the 1970s and in the present. And if you Google golf courses, you will see that we have these wide range of courses of highly sophisticated facilities, fancy clubs, and so on. And at the same time, you have these global corporations, financial global corporations playing a role. So in many ways, I will argue that when we try to understand the expansion of empire and capitalism, the connection between capitalism, imperialism, even more, the idea of racial capitalism, this sport offers a wonderful window to explore the idea. If you think like, what is the relationship between this sport and global capitalism or racial capitalism, just think about the role of grass in portraying notions of whiteness. Grass is that quintessential element that all over the world represents early on Britain and later on the United States. Any single movie portraying upper class people in the United States in which white folks are represented at large, sooner or later will show us a shot in which a large part of the house, country club, etc., has this sort of perfect, immaculate grass lawn. So in many ways, I think I argue that one of the fascinations, global fascinations about this sport, among some other things that we can talk about in a second, it is grass and the way in which grass globally represents first the reproduction of the British landscape in foreign lands and later as a sort of white consumption, upper middle class habit of the United States.
Right. So my next question is more specific to your work on Mexico, and I would want to know how racial perceptions influence the distribution of resources, opportunities, as well as status positions in the country.
Ah, that is also an amazing question. In the case of Mexico and Latin America, it seems to me that in Mexico and Latin America have an inverted argument from the United States. Whereas in the United States, the idea is that the American dream is the standard, and as such, class seems to be irrelevant, and then race seems to be like the thing that divides U.S. society. In Latin America, people, since the creation of modern nations in the 19th century, argue the opposite. In the Declaration of Independence, in the early writings of the founders of all these different nations, the issue of class was never addressed in the way in which the issue of racial inequality was addressed. So these societies were founded under the argument that racial equality was one of the main aims of the modern independent nation. And as such, we have in all Latin America a variation of mixed race, or what is called in Spanish mestizaje, which argues that a long history of interracial marriage has created a society in which folks are of all type of colors. And actually the color of skin and physical features are not important. You may be black, you may be brown, you may be of Asian characteristic features or white features, and actually that is relevant because race doesn't influence in any way the distribution of resources, access to education, and so on. So this has been the dominant paradigm that has shaped Latin American societies. However, when we look at the composition of elites in every single nation in Latin America, every single one of them, and when we contrast that the composition of elites against the composition of folks who are at the very bottom of the class hierarchy, we have something very peculiar, which is white or folks who will actually qualified as white under U.S. standards are overrepresented in the elite, and folks of black indigenous features are as well overrepresented at the very bottom of the class hierarchy. And then if race doesn't matter, and actually class is that thing that organizes this society, we shouldn't find this type of consistent pattern. We should be able to find all sorts of colors and physical features at the very top, and all sorts of colors and physical features at the bottom, being class, that element that organizes society. But that's not the case. We have this overrepresentation of white folks or folks who may or may not identify as white openly. However, when we take images and we look and we do interviews and we access some of these spaces, we have this overrepresentation of local notions of whiteness, which I insist in many cases are similar to North American ideas of whiteness and European ideas of whiteness. So in this case, my work is part of a small group of researchers trying to show that actually against the idea that race or racial ideas or ethnic ideas are not relevant, I am trying to show the opposite. Like, that's not true. When we start pulling numbers, when we start doing ethnographic work, we see the opposite. We see that race does matter in the way in which people look for partners, for example. The issue of looking for a long-term partner, the way in which certain phenotypical features are considered more desirable. And the issue, of course, doesn't stop in, it's not an issue of beauty. I know that some people may think like, well, if that's beauty, who cares? It is really not that important. We should pay attention to something more important. I do argue that this problem doesn't stop there. It goes beyond that, and actually it penetrates the society up to the point in which resources are distributed, the way in which societies and cities are organized, and the way in which some folks, those at the bottom of the class hierarchy, are not only poor on their traditional class analysis, but are also racialized ways that makes things more difficult to argue that class is the only reason why some of these groups are at the very bottom, and make us think that mainly or probably alongside class, resources have been historically distributed on the racial lines. That would be my argument of why we need to pay more attention to the distribution of racial the way in which individuals are connected to their racial features of some individuals are connected to class dynamics.
Right. So since we are talking about dynamics, let me also ask you how you think historical dynamics, or if at all, they do impact the contemporary relations of privilege. Do you think that the historical window offers an analysis of how golf has developed in Mexico throughout the 20th century?
Wow. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a beautiful piece by a sociologist, Norbert Elias, in which the piece is The Retreat, the title of the piece, The Retreat of Sociologists into the Present. And Elias makes the point that we should, as sociologists, we should pay attention to the way in which historical dynamics are fundamental to understand the articulation of present day social structures. And we can think of Du Bois, one of the most recently celebrated scholars in the United States, and the way in which he was going constantly back to history to try to understand the exclusion of Black Americans. Following that line of thinking, I argue that the only way to understand why this sport is so important in the present among corporate, among business and economic elites, it is to go back in history and to understand the trajectory. To give you an example, the most exclusive club today in Mexico actually was founded in the 1940s as a reef in between two clubs. One group of members didn't like the idea of accepting more Mexicans, more locals into the club and letting them participate in the administrative roles in the club. Whereas some other part of that first club was excited about this option of accepting more locals. This club was founded as the enclave of British and American economic elites that were doing business in Mexico. So by the late 30s, there's this rift between these two clubs, and some members decided to go and founded a different club in which they will keep this space as the enclave of Anglo-American elites. That club is the most exclusive club in the present. And also, when we think about this history or the history of this club, there's also something as well about the way in which a sense of Anglo-American culture and its connection with whiteness was present since the very origins of the sport and since the origins of the foundation on some of the clubs. And I don't think it is not a coincidence that this club is still the most important in the country and the way in which it has sort of preserved its Anglo-Saxon-ness at the core. I recall as part of the interviews, I interview an Asian executive, someone who was an executive from Japan, who told me that he had heard that in this club, the most important executives working for large Asian corporations, they could go there and play, but they are not allowed to buy memberships. I was not able to corroborate that piece of information, but considering the long history of this club and the way in which it was founded, there is something about capitalism and whiteness that I think is present, and the history of these spaces provide those deep clues about how that was organized and some of the present dynamics.
Okay. So you also say in your book that women occupy a paradoxical position in the what is otherwise the affluent world of golf in Mexico. I am very interested to know a little more about this, and if you could explain this with a few examples.
Sure, of course. Usually, again, people, actually at the very beginning when I approached these sites, I didn't see gender as an important element. To me, the whole community was composed by extremely wealthy people. And then my early interest was trying to understand how exactly class operates and class privilege operates in these settings. When I started, and then in early presentations of my work, I recall finding female researchers asking me about gender. And with a degree of embarrassment, I should confess that at the beginning, my answer was, I don't know. And I was thinking to myself, I don't see how gender may be relevant in this case. Later on, when I started interviewing female members, I discovered exactly the opposite, that gender is fundamental in the organization of the community, that there are mechanisms through which gender overrides class distinctions. Let me be more specific. In some of the most important clubs, women have a set of restrictions on the days in which they can play, on the spaces that they can access or not, one of them being the bar. The main bar is a sort of forbidden space for most for women. One may think, well, who cares if the bar is banned for women? It's actually relevant. No, it is not. The bar is the space in which all what happened in the course becomes visible for the whole community. Unlike a regular bar in which people will contain the conversation and jokes to one's own table, in the bar of the clubs I visited, I found that people were sharing jokes, and then people in the following table or two tables in front of us and so on were participating. They were shouting back a joke. They were talking about an important torment, internal torment. So I realized that the bar was that space in which members could hear about the playing skills of other members, or who was a witty person to play with, or who tells the most funny jokes, or who has the most fascinating, outlandish way of playing, etc. And based on that, players start looking for each other to play with, and then networks are expanded. The fact that women cannot access these spaces sort of put them outside of the view of other men. And when I started asking men about the distinction, could you please tell me more about how different it is the game of women and men, I consistently heard these comments about, I don't know about women, I don't play with women, I never see them playing. I can tell you about my wife, I can tell you about my sister, I can tell you about my daughter, but outside of that really close circle, men didn't have a clear understanding. And then when I cross and start interviewing women, I have these narratives in which women complain about the mistreatment they constantly are subject to, based on the ignorant position of women, the way in which men are unable to differentiate between amazing players and so-so players, and the way in which they think of all female players as just bad players. I recall the case of one interviewee who told me and showed me, I'm an amazing player. I can easily defeat more than half of the men in this club. However, I have heard so many times jokes about my playing skills by folks who have never played with me, by folks who have never seen me playing. And then as part of this conversation, I asked her whether she felt that this type of mistreatment was carried over on her professional life, and she immediately answered yes. The same perception about gender and that I am a clumsy player is also present in the way in which some executives who have no clue who I am sometimes tell jokes about female executives and so on. So then I found that, that gender was important. But then I also found that gender became more important than class. And in this case, I started asking player or club members if they can share with me how they start playing. I found in the case of women that most of them started playing with their fathers. They told me this story. Oh, when I was 7 years old, I was coming to the club with my father. We're playing. I started playing with him. Later on, I took some lessons. So these women, by way of having a family that had a membership in some of these clubs for at least two generations, were signaling their solid upper middle class, upper class upbringing. And when I asked about their partners, some of them told me how their partners, or now their husbands, didn't learn the sport until later in life. It was after they got married that they, through her connections, that the couple managed to buy a membership and then join the club. Once they joined the club, women were subject to all these restrictions in terms of times to play, in terms of spaces they could access, among many other issues. But the husband, who may now be part of the upper middle, may now be part of the upper class, but was not necessarily part of the upper middle upper class in his upbringing, which that doesn't mean either that he was part of the working class. He was more likely part of a middle class bordering the upper middle class or some sort of bordering line. But by being male, they access all this set of privileges that were banned for women, despite women's higher class origins, they were subject to all these restrictions. So what I found is that women in these spaces are subordinated, privileged individuals. They are subordinated by their gender identity, not by class identity. In terms of class, they are the same as their peers, but in terms of gender, they are treated differently. And the irony I found among these wealthy women is that no single one of them suggested that they wanted to engage in an open fight to reverse this pattern. They complained deeply and they were very clear about these inequalities, but they didn't think of organizing an open rebellion. And for quite some time, I was sort of puzzled. Why didn't they want to openly engage with strategies to completely reverse this gender inequality and to create a more equal, in gender terms, relationship? And my argument is that part of the irony is that if they engage in an open rebellion, they may tarnish, they may destroy all the things and mechanisms and structures that give them privilege in the very first place. So they may also find themselves losing that privilege. And it seems that some of them prefer to keep that subordinated position overall in the community, but keep their overall privilege within national contexts. This is what I found like doing research among these communities.
Very interesting. It in fact mirrors a lot of experiences of what women's sport fans can also probably relate to. And I can vouch for it being an avid sports fan myself. Last question, Hugo. How does this book represent a renewed call to arms, a phrase that you use for social scientists who are interested in studying privilege?
Well, I'm trying to make the case that we should look up more often, that we need to pay attention to those with power. And we know from time to time, we read those journalistic pieces showing how since the late 1970s, 1980s onwards, all around the world, it is not one single country. And we have Piketty's book about capital showing us how, with some variations, of course, in some cases more acute than in others, what we have is this hyper-concentration of wealth in the hands of very few folks all over the world. And sometimes I wonder, and I think I present that reflection in the book, I wonder to what extent our work at social scientists have produced a lot of information and research about the poor. To what extent all our books, articles, research have led policymakers and those in the world of translating academic research into policy, we have produced enough understanding of how to better control, better police, better keep working class communities in a position in which they cannot fight back against new policies, new ways of exploitation, etc. But when we think about the opposite, in every single case and in every single country, this is not about one country or another, in every single country, what we have is that we have very limited understanding of those folks with plenty of resources. We don't have a deep sense of their notions of gender, notions of violence, notions of their aspirations, their views on the poor, among many others. We barely understand that part. And then my reflection is, to what extent that may have allowed the upper middle and upper classes all around the world to deeply exploited neoliberal capitalism in the last 30 years, and to what extent that may partially explain the fact that we are still discussing whether taxes may be relevant or not. It seems that we're in square one when we think about how to tackle the huge class inequalities that we see all over the world. But when we think about the opposite, we have a lot of information about peasants, about workers, about the urban poor, about the lower middle classes, etc. But we have no information about those folks at the very top. In that regards, I am sort of inviting my fellow social scientists. We need to find ways, new ways to look at those with power. We need to find new ways to explore research mechanisms, research techniques to understand how the inequality that we see in the world needs to be tackled. And this is not something of envy sociological project, but rather, how can we create more functional societies? So far, if I think of Latin American societies, and of course, it's not only Latin America, we have highly dysfunctional societies in which a handful of families control national economies. I don't think that's good for me. I don't think that's good for a country. I don't think that's good for all of us, the environment including. So I will invite people. We have in social media the great possibility to develop new techniques to do research about the wealthy and try to find ways to develop more information.
Right. Thank you so much once again for doing this interview, for giving our viewers, rather listeners, the opportunity to hear about your fantastic book. And I'm also excited about its Spanish open access publication. And hopefully more and more people read it as well as listen to your fascinating interview for the NBN. Thank you once again, Hugo, for making time out for this.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really excited, and I hope that the conversation make some folks interested in looking up in different societies. Thank you very much.